You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 315.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have finally reached another Local Maximum. Took a little break from the podcast here, and, you know, I had a whole lot of things to talk to you about. A whole lot of topics that I want to get to. Not all today. We're going to start with one thing today. And, you know, I was going to do it with a solo show. And I'm like, you know what? I need a little feedback here. I need someone to kind of help me figure out what's interesting. So, of course, we've got Aaron back on the program. Aaron, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. As tempted as I was, I'm not going to go for the comedic moment there and just give dead air when you ask for feedback.
Oh, I don't know what I'd do to you. Nothing, because you're like several hundred miles away. Okay. So, it's been a long, cold winter. It's still a little cold. I just got back from a really neat trip in Fort Mojave. We're going to talk about a little bit. That's with the Yale Alumni Service Corps. Now, the last trip, the Yale Alumni Service Corps is basically a group of Yale alumni, of which I am one, and it's kind of funded privately, but it's affiliated with the university. And they go on trips to different underserved communities around the world and also within the United States. So, my first trip was to the Dominican Republic. Then I went to Nicaragua twice. Then I went to Ghana. The last time I did it, they actually asked me to lead the trip. So every trip has... They have kind of a professional employee who goes. That's Joao Alexio. It's always a pleasure to work with. And then they have like a volunteer leader. So in 2017, we were doing as you can imagine, Aaron, these trips to like Africa, A, they're expensive, and B, they take a lot out of you. They're very hard. Even the one that I just did to Nevada took a lot out of me, I'll tell you. And I have so many stories about that. But in 2017, I was so excited because we're going to not only we're going to an Indian reservation, and I'm always really interested in kind of Native American culture. Also, it's within the United States. And so it's not as underserved as some of the other places we've been to. And in fact, this time it's more called like a cultural exchange. It's really fascinating, and it's a lot easier to do. I spent a day in Vegas, and then we did a week there. Last time I did the same thing. I spent a day in Vegas and then more time in Vegas afterwards. But the Fort Mojave Indian Reservation, if you imagine the shape of Nevada, they have a hotel casino resort kind of a thing, which is about 2 hours from Vegas. It's definitely not Vegas. It's the Avi Casino. It's a little bit. It's very different. You know, it's a little bit more off the beaten path. I would say it's more like a community type place. But now people go there. That's how the local tribal government. You know, that's their economy is based off that stuff. But if you imagine the shape of Nevada, you know how it comes down to a point at the southern tip, and so. That casino is right at the southern tip of Nevada. So literally right across the Colorado River is Arizona, and across the street there is California. The economy seems to be based off of casinos in one state, guns in another state, and marijuana dispensaries in the third state. I shouldn't be so... I don't want to offend anyone.
One, if they so chose, could refer to it as a triangle of sin, but we won't judge.
No, but well, yes. And by the way, not all of this land and these communities are part of the Native American reservation, which is interesting because on the Arizona side, the shape of the tribal lands is a checkerboard. And
So the reservation does overlap the state lines.
Yeah, the reservation does overlap the state lines. And in fact, the school I was working in was in Arizona, which is an hour difference, which is very confusing. So every time
Is Arizona the one that doesn't do daylight savings?
I think so.
They don't change their clocks?
Oh, then maybe it was the same time. I don't know. I never knew what time it was there. So the first time I went there, the first time I went there was 2017. And that was when I was planning on doing the podcast. So I was actually telling people when I was there, like, oh, I'm planning to start a podcast. And the participants would give me ideas. By the way, I was leading the trip. Almost everyone else on the trip was like much older than me. So that was kind of strange. So this time I was happy to sit back and let other people lead it. And I was just one of the participants. And my job was to build robots, do robotics with students in the school there. Since I've been there, they built this beautiful elementary school and also a beautiful wellness center, which is like a gym that, you know, any really nice gym you'd want to be a part of. Like it kind of feels like that, along with like you get smoothies and everything. Protein shakes. So that was really rewarding this time. I think we had a little bit of trouble because the group, my team was five people to teach robotics. We had to put together a robot. It's like the Elegoo kits. There are these little robotics kits. It's for 12 and up. I put it together. It was a little hard because, you know, there's tiny little screws there that you have to do.
It wasn't all like, you know, Legos, you know, everything snaps together. It required some tools.
Oh yeah. It required some tools and it required really keeping track of these, like really making sure that you get the parts right. There are a few things that could go on backwards and that of course did go on backwards. But there wasn't too much of that. But of course when we got there, there were five of us. Two people got sick, so there were three of us. And, oh, by the way, the kids aren't 11. They're 8 and 9. So very different. But you know what? The first day, they finished building all their robots. And yes. One of the kids was like, I never thought I could finish this. And then we tried to get into programming them. And we tried teaching them if-then statements. And, if-then-else. I think kids say very funny things. You know, we asked, what do you think else means? And someone raised his hand and says, or else I beat you up. And I don't think he was being, my sense was he wasn't being a smartass. He was actually like, that is the phrase that he's heard else before. But, you know, I think I think they were doing some very neat programming with it. They were kind of, making the cars go in circles and squares and having them like avoid obstacles because there's an ultrasonic, right? So one of the variables that you can get is how far the nearest wall is, and you could also turn the ultrasonic. So they didn't get to like the real complicated part where it's like, okay, turn the ultrasonic right and left and see if there's like a good place that you could turn to. But they definitely did a whole like, oh, if you're getting close to a wall, stop and back up. And I had the idea like turn a random amount each time so that eventually you'll get unstuck. So that was the
Roomba approach.
Yeah. Yeah. It looked like Roombas, but every day kind of there was a little bit of that, and then it just divided into, well, they just wanted to ride around the robots and then look at the camera on the, you know, and start smashing them together, which who wouldn't? So it was a wonderful time. I think, you know, we took a hike at the beginning at one of their kind of protected sacred sites where there's like a lot of, it's in the desert basically, and there's all these carvings in the stone there, we're not really sure what they represent. I mean, there's little like animals, little like lines and diagrams that might look like people, but I honestly don't know how to stay there. Yeah, it was pretty neat. And of course we got to see like kind of the traditional dances and traditional music and things like that. So really great time. I got back a few days ago.
What tribe was this? I don't know if you said
the Fort Mojave Indian Reservation. I guess you could say the Mojave, or you know, usually they say Ahamakav, I think is right, or Ahamakav. So something like that, which is, you know, became Mojave when it was anglicized. Because Fort Mojave was
Mojave Desert as well, right?
Or am I? Yes, mixing that's things? Yes. Okay. And that's more in California. I guess the Mojave, I should know more about this, but the reason why it's called Fort Mojave was because the American government built a fort there because, you know, with the new Arizona territory, people kind of taking the Southern Trail to LA and San Diego, gotcha. You know, from the east. And it's brutal over there. The heat, it wasn't hot this time we went in March, but the California town that's there is called Needles, California. It's based off these Needles Mountain that looks like needles, but I kind of feel like it's called Needles because that's how the sun feels on your skin when you're in there. At least it did in 2017 when we were there in October. It can get like 120 degrees in the summer. You know, I think when I was there in October, it was like 105, but wow. in March, it was like 70 every day. It was perfect.
A little bit different than up here in New England.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I would like to have the tribal administrator on the show, Ashley Hemmers, because I worked, she went to Yale as well, actually close to my year, I think. I don't know if it's exactly my year, but we definitely overlapped. I didn't know her when she was there. And that's sort of why we were able to, you know, the university was able to make this connection because they had an alumnus there.
I'm assuming as tribal administrator that she is a member of the tribe, or is that
yeah, she grew up there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. She grew up there. Yeah. She's a member. She grew up there. It helps to grow up there. Just like any community. I found it really neat that they had on the walls of the school, like everything in English, but everything also in their traditional language. So it was not like kind of almost reviving the language a little bit. I guess it would be hard to, I don't know if anyone speaks it like day to day. I guess that would be hard to do because there's so few people. But it's good to see that kind of cultural.
How big a population lives on the reservation? You know, order of magnitude wise, are you talking?
That's a good question.
Couple hundred or?
My guess is thousands. Let me actually look that up. So,
but it also sounds like there's not really like, you know, a concentrated population that.
Yeah,
that they may be spread over a pretty wide area there as well.
Yeah, school gives me 1735 people. So, yeah, not that many, but yeah, it people have misconceptions. It was kind of just like going into pretty much any elementary school in America. I feel like would have been a similar experience, and so it was a good time. It's I do feel like these kids will grow up and they might not realize it now, but they have kind of like a very special thing about them that they're part of this kind of unique culture, even though they grow up in the United States, they're American. It's not like it's unlike the other trips we do. It's very obvious that you're in the United States and you're in like, you know, but so, you know, these kids will grow up in America, but then they'll realize that they have this very special, like kind of, identity and cultural knowledge. So I don't know. I think that's pretty cool, but, maybe there's more that could be said about this, but unfortunately I was focused on my job. I haven't thought about this too deeply.
Yeah. It's tough to judge from the outside. I'm sure there's an inside view on that we're missing some of the nuance of, but
sure. Sure.
I think that's a positive, positive light to hold it in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really got that feeling. Okay. So today I want to talk about a book that I've been reading. It didn't take me that long to read the book. One good thing about taking flights is you could read books very quickly. I don't know why I guess it's because there's nothing else to do on the flights,
but I've been reading this audience.
Yeah. I've been reading this 2019 book called Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. I don't know if you've heard of Cal Newport. He was mentioned all the way back in episode 12 of the podcast when we were talking about digital friends and digital enemies. And this was with Marissa Chacko. And we were talking about how technology can reduce your ability to work. And so at the time, Cal Newport had a book out called Deep Work about how to attack that. But I think now he's kind of with digital minimalism, he's more tackled the issue head on, which is more like, okay, how could you use technology? You know, there are so many digital enemies out there. How can you use technology in a way that is helpful to yourself and to your own life? And I think taking a step back, as I have over the last couple of months, has really helped me do that. I don't think I have removed. I honestly, I haven't like done what the book says. I haven't like removed all these things in my life, but I've started to a little bit. Of course, the book says, yes, of course, the book says that doesn't work. But we'll see. So, I think that the point of the book is that the market, can produce things that are not so healthy for you. And the example of the book is like casinos and tobacco, which, unfortunately, you made the connection before, which I wasn't, expecting. But of course, the hotel I was staying at was a casino, and there was a lot of smoking there. So, you know, we could look at that and say, "Oh, look, that's not healthy." But of course, you know, just because there's that going on in one part of the country, we're essentially doing the same thing with our sedentary lifestyles and our kind of perpetual outrage. The book asks the questions, how do you take it back? How do you take back your life from your phone, from your digital enemies, both personally and from a society level? So he gives a bunch of principles for digital minimalism. The first is to kind of optimize online time to the things you value. And in order to do that, that requires you to think about what you value the most. So I definitely spend time on sites that are or time on things that I don't value. Sometimes I think I was in the mistaken mindset that, well, if I'm spending a lot of time on this site, I guess that's what I value. But I think you have to go the other way around.
What is that that term from economics? Is it like revealed preferences? That it may not be what you report you want to do, but if you spent time doing it, then apparently you wanted to.
Yes. But I think that more applies to kind of deceptive practices where people are saying one thing and doing another. But I feel like that term is more, well, I don't know. It could apply to people who
there's believe something to be captured there in terms of how someone responds on a self-reported survey about things and how they actually behave. And
right.
I certainly would not be surprised that there are significant differences there. As a survey respondent, I know that I have difficulty, self-evaluating. Performance review self-evaluations are always a challenge for me because, maybe I know myself best, but that doesn't mean I can actually give an accurate report.
Right. And so a lot of this kind of self-reporting what you value, I don't think it means that what you're actually doing is what you value. I think you're kind of getting into routines that are not in your interest that you might want to change. Or maybe, our lives, we just stay the status quo until we're forced out of it or we force ourselves out of it.
Yeah, the corollary would be, okay, this is what you've done, but how happy are you with that? If you could, would you change it? And again, there's room for self-deception there. And, are you giving an honest answer? Or are you saying what you think people want to hear? But I think there can often be a difference between what you've actually done and what you wish you had done.
Yeah, and exactly. And there's one point that he makes that really applies to social media very well. I don't know what social media you have on your phone. I have Reddit and Twitter, and those, I can't seem to kick those habits, even though I feel like I get something out of it, but probably not much. But then there's time that I have that's like, okay, this is dead time, so there's no reason not to use it. So I'm not really sure how I feel about that. But the point that he's making is, it's not enough for a service to provide a benefit. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to have this on my phone. I'm going to have this in front of me because it does XYZ for me. Sure, it does XYZ for you, but you have to balance the benefit with the cost. And already just the clutter is the cost. It's usually not a monetary cost. It's ads, it's time. And so a lot of people join social media because of fear of missing out, FOMO, that they might get some benefit that they're missing out on. And so if you're worried about missing out on social interaction, for example, I think the point is maybe physical events are better, you know, which is hence one of the things that I enjoyed about this trip that I went on. But maybe there are some local physical events that that will also be enjoyable as well.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree, but it becomes a challenge when we are spread across the earth as we are. You know, it's we no longer live close enough that I can just pop over to your place to hang out.
I know, I missed that,
which is unfortunate. And you know, and I don't have too many local friends that I do that with. So it makes the next best thing of congregating virtually attractive, but are we too easily substituting that, falling back to that, when really we should be instead making the effort to do the real in-person things that, okay, yeah, it might be a little bit harder, but it potentially is worth the extra effort.
Yeah,
I think very, very much in line with this kind of cost benefit analysis thing is that we're taking the path of least resistance and not considering what we're giving up to do that.
Right. I find that Reddit and Twitter, for example, are the most toxic when there's some when there's some like crazy event going on, and not event, like some like news item, and everyone's giving their hot takes, and then there's some kind of outrage that you almost get addicted to. I call out people for getting addicted to outrage. I think it's terrible, but I'm almost addicted to it as well, because there's sort of a very easy slide to like, oh, I want to hear all opinions, so I might as well seek them out, to I'm going to get outraged today because I'm going to hear all opinions, you know. So I'm not sure where to stop that slippery slope.
I don't know where least, to... I have at least one podcast I listen to that I don't listen to every episode of it, but when I see a subject that comes up, I'm like, oh, that's an interesting topic. And I know full well that I'm going to get angry listening to it, because the people on it, they're not always wrong, but they're coming from a very different viewpoint than me. And even when they're right and I agree with them, I'm angry that I agree with them, because the way that they're presenting things or the lens through which they're viewing is if not diametrically opposed to me, is just very different than mine. And even though I know that I will, upwards of 75% of the time when I listen to an episode of that, I will get angry about it, I still do it. And maybe it's because I have seen a calculated cost benefit analysis there that it's good to expose myself to that differing viewpoint. And they do, have, valuable observations and input, but I could also be deceiving myself, because I want that dopamine kick of having somebody that it's real easy for me to point at and get angry.
Right. And outrage sells. Outrage is fun. And it's not like, there are also people who, like, you might like listening to, who are, they get you outraged at other people that you agree are wrong. And it's like, okay, this is fun, but how much can we take? What is a healthy amount of this that we could take? And that is a balance that I don't know how to achieve. Of course, you could become a monk and live in the middle of the woods or something, but that's just not something that is in the cards for me. It's just not something that's going to happen. So I don't know. So a few principles of digital minimalism that I think is important to go over. Of course, I would encourage you to read the book, to actually, if you want to get the Cal Newport kind of prescription on how you're going to achieve all this. So I feel like I'm not going to get the full benefit until I do what he says. But principle number one, clutter is costly. And I just found that today or last night, because when I got home from this trip, I cleaned out this desk here. I had all these papers, all these tax documents. I put all of my papers in different piles, like all across the floor, in order to categorize them. It took me all day. The biggest pile of papers, by the way, was medical, like explanation of benefits, and just I don't know why they send me these letters that, you know, you're like, I'm not sure I have to keep this, but apparently every time you get a fingernail, that's like 30 pages, you know, or a fingernail or hangnail is 30 pages of documentation come to your house, in America, at least. So that was the biggest one. And finally I decluttered my desk. I have now my podcast equipment and microphone are going to be out here permanently. I think that's going to help with the podcast a lot. I'm excited to sit down here. I'm not like all worried about something falling off the back. Wow. Clutter is costly. He's absolutely right. Now, digital clutter is also costly. So a couple things I did. Okay. I went through my apps. I deleted some apps that I might not need. Some of them made their way back. So that's still a problem. But another thing I did was I redid my email, my email filters on Gmail. And
I did an inbox zero thing a couple years ago and I got pretty close, but I've definitely fallen off of that wagon.
Right, right. And remember, you do have, there is this tendency to say, oh, well, I don't want to skip the inbox on that because I might miss something, you know? But remember the rule. It's the cost versus the benefit. Keep the cost in mind as well. So principle number two, optimization is important. So a lot of this decluttering is also optimization. And then three, intentionality is satisfying. One of the figures that Newport mentions a lot is an early literary figure in American history, Henry David Thoreau, who was kind of a New England writer.
This is Walden Pond, yeah. Thoreau, right?
Yes. Super famous. I don't know why I'm describing who Thoreau is, but maybe there are people who don't know who he is. So he kind of lived alone in the woods, but as mentioned in the book, he didn't really live out in the middle of nowhere. Like, he was near towns and stuff, but he wanted to get solace and sort of a little bit of alone time in order to produce the wonderful works of literature that he did that are still in libraries and bookstores and still quoted, you know, 200 years later almost. So,
little Thoreau aside, a Thoreau away story, if you will.
Love it.
So when he was living, you know, in his cabin by the lake, one of the gotcha stories that I've heard about that is, well, he wasn't actually, he may have been quote unquote living alone, but he wasn't doing it all on his own. I believe, in fact, his mother came out and did his laundry for him. That sounds like item number two. That is optimization. If he's out there for the purpose of, getting mental clarity and writing his books, that maybe it is not an effective use of his time to be doing his own laundry or, you know, growing his own food or whatever. If you were to take, you know, the extreme, go live out in the wilderness approach, that he outsourced some things to be effective and focus on where his strengths were.
So it's mentioned in the book that his purpose was not to like get as far away from civilization as possible. Also, I can imagine how rough it would have been to do laundry back then. It's not like now where you could just throw it in the machine, you know. It was like serious business. So the third principle, by the way, I want to go back to is intentionality, because I was sort of unsure how to state it. But Cal Newport writes, digital minimalists derive significant satisfaction from their general commitment to being more intentional about how they engage with new technologies. This sort of satisfaction is independent of the specific decisions they make and is one of the biggest reasons that minimalism tends to be immensely meaningful to its practitioners. So I would like to do that. I feel like anything that pops into my head, I end up Googling or going down a rabbit hole on. And it gets to be too much.
That can be useful sometimes, but yeah, I mean, I would almost read that intentionality as satisfying as don't let the algorithm make your decisions for you.
Yeah,
you know, if you're going to open up an app, you know, it's I'm doing it for this reason, and when I have accomplished that task, I'm done. Now, sometimes you want to go on a wiki wander and see where it leads you, but you know, I've definitely, I think it's exactly what you were talking about before, that oh, I have time to kill, and so I will use this application to fill that time, and you end up going places and doing things that maybe they're interesting, but they're almost certainly not things you would have specifically elected to spend time doing.
So I'm reading another book, which we'll get to later. I feel like I'm going to read a lot of good books this year, and we're going to get to discuss it here in the Local Maximum. But I'm reading a book about cellular automaton, and particularly Conway's Game of Life. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I had a version of it on, I think, one of my first PCs.
Okay, well,
it was right up there with Minesweeper.
You could imagine the rabbit holes of apps and YouTube videos that you could watch with those things. And oh, so I've done it. So hopefully we can get back to you with a show on it where we could talk about it. And, you know, you don't have to go into the rabbit hole, or we could introduce you to that rabbit hole. So I don't know. That might actually be useful. I think that I'll be on this rabbit hole for, I don't know, a few weeks, and then it will kind of die down. Hopefully we'll get a good show out of it. Hopefully we'll get good insights out of it. I have written about Conway's Game of Life before, but I feel like I have so much more of an intuition as to what's going on these days that I'm excited to talk about it. But anyway, it is certainly also a rabbit hole where I found myself staring at unfolding cellular automaton for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes. And I'm like, why did I just spend my time doing that? I know it's going to sputter out. I know it's going to happen. I've watched this same video before.
Are you sure? It could be perpetual motion.
They could have changed the ending, right? Yeah. And if it is perpetual motion, like, is that important? I don't know. I mean, then again, there's gaming, right? Gaming is kind of fun. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But yeah. Anyway, another point that Newport makes, and I'm curious to know what you think of this, he considers the whole like culture to be toxic. He actually recommends you stay away from it entirely. I'm not sure if I could do that, but he says people have it in their heads that these are kind of small social interactions that add up to something big, and that it's a mirage. It doesn't add up to anything. It's sort of like, kind of like false, I don't know, false kind of triggering of your social mind, that thinking there's something there when there's something there, I guess, but there it's not something that is of any use to you.
I want to say that the context matters, and this might be me grasping for a justification, because I know that, I don't spend too much time on social media, but I do. Well, that there's an aside to go with that. But the places I've spent the most time of late have been, various Slacks and Discords. And I am very much tied into the slot machine of I'm going to make a comment. And often I am trying to make a humorous comment, and I want to see the people make, you know, give reactions to that. And I can see it's almost, you know, as if I were doing a stand-up comedy gig. You know, it's like I'm testing out my material here and seeing what kind of reaction I get. And part of it is specifically I can see, you know, who's reacting how. And it's, you could say that that's no different than, you know, if you're at a party and you tell a joke and you can tell, you know, looking around in the group you're in, who's laughing and who's not. But at the same time, if I couldn't tell who was giving those reactions, I would still get a dopamine hit from just seeing people, you know, like or thumbs up or whatever emoji they're putting on it. And,
right.
And it makes me feel a little bit dirty to do that like I'm it's not exactly fishing for compliments, but I'm definitely fishing for a reaction when I do that.
I've been commenting on Reddit more often recently, and I don't know why I do it. I'm just like, somebody says something, and then I have a response, so I say it. And then I'm like, well, why am I even doing this? What's the point? I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I guess it's useful for people, but it's not useful to like go on someone's long, like rant or debate and to be like, well, to be fair, you're not exactly true on this. And to just put your to just put your stamp in there like that. It just seems like a completely useless exercise. I've had some people respond to me on Reddit where they're like so nasty that I start to respond back. I'm like, who cares? You know, get out of it. You know, and then they like get in your head and you're like, why am I doing this? So yeah, I
would say that part of intentionality is being able to intentionally disengage when you sense that, oh, this is going a place that's not going to help me, and being able to step away. And sometimes that's harder than other times.
So this is not nearly the, this is a more, this is a lighter example, but I'm on this subreddit called Decadology, and it's all like, oh, like 2006 was like this, and like 2011 was like this. And like, they'll have like these little arguments about did the 2000s end in 2011 or 2012 based on the cultural changes. And like, you know, people would be like, it's 2024. Why does it feel like the 2010s? Usually young people, you know, say that. And it's kind of like, okay, like I'll comment about how things were in a particular year from my impression, but then people have a debate like it's some objective fact that like the culture shifted in this particular year. And how dare you
flashbacks to the fourth turning.
You're not even allowed to talk about the turning stuff because it has to be more about hairstyles and music and things like that.
But technology. Are we millennials or are we not?
It definitely has some overlap with the fourth turning. That's probably how I got into it. But some of these people on here just seem like they've got it all figured out. They have, you know, it's undoubtedly this is the truth. Just look at it with your own eyes. You ever see someone arguing like, oh, this is undoubtedly the case. Just look at it with your own eyes. And you're like, okay, but there's overwhelming evidence. You never see the evidence, but people can just say that, you know what I mean? And then it's like hard to have that discussion because then you feel like you're coming from a completely different, you know, you don't want to get back to square one with anything.
The advantage to having that kind of, to call it charitably, a discussion on the internet is that there is the potential to bring in sources and cite it. Whereas if someone were to make that kind of an assertion at, you know, at a party, or you know, out at a bar or whatever, even if you were to pull out your phone and, you know, and cite some data or some resource, you'd be the weirdo for doing that. Like who does that?
Yeah.
Now maybe that just makes things worse.
I'm happy to hear people's
in those other situations, it's the out for disengaging is easier. You say, okay, yeah, whatever. You know, move on to the next topic. Whereas on the internet, you can keep beating that drum and you know, keep the flywheel of the argument spinning indefinitely.
Yeah, and some arguments you can have both sides cite things ad infinitum, and you never get a clear answer. Oh,
my favorite is when both sides cite the same resource but draw completely different conclusions from like the same exact data.
Yeah, it could happen too. Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very common. Okay, so Newport says that some people have gotten rid of their phones, or like they don't take their phones out with them. And he's like, look, people think you're crazy for going outside the home without your phone. That's what everybody in human history used to do. You know, you don't need it.
And we're like the last generation that remembers that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So some people have a dumb phone strategy where they just bring a phone that can call. There's a strategy that I might be able to try, although I feel like I need my phone like for work and things like that, but it's the Apple Watch strategy. So maybe if I, you know, I could take a call on my Apple Watch, and I could sort of text on my Apple Watch. It would be kind of a pain, but you know, if I need to get some information to someone, it has a, you know, you can hear something, and I could check in on Foursquare Swarm on Apple Watch. So there's a lot of things you could do with your Apple Watch, but you're not going to be scrolling through it all day. Right. That might be a possibility. I remember before all that, when I used to work at Wireless Generation, And oh, by the way, Wireless Generation Education Company, now Amplify. I was so excited to see that in the elementary school where I was working.
Cool.
So that was pretty cool. I have to send that to the CEO. So when I was working at Wireless Generation, that was 2006, 2009, right? I remember sometimes being so freaking bored on the subway. I wouldn't know what to do. I'd have my dumb phone with me. It was like, it was torture. And then occasionally I would bring books, and I got a lot of good reading done over that time on the subway. So that certainly is a possibility, an Apple Watch and a book. I want to think about that. Of course, now with the work from home culture, I don't know how you get rid of your phone. It's just here, you know, unless you just don't have one.
You could try silencing notifications and do not disturb, but I'm betting that that's something that Newport says doesn't work.
It works to an extent. I don't think he's saying you have to remove everything forever, but he's saying like remove most things. There's like a way to go, and then slowly add them back in with intentionality is essentially the way to go. So you're almost resetting, and I suppose you need to do that occasionally, because it's not like, you know, it's like you clean your house, and then eventually you have to clean it again. So I imagine that at least the first time maybe might be much worse, because you have to kind of really get away from things for much longer. I've figured out a way to kind of remove myself from services. It doesn't work for Reddit and Twitter because I could just log in through Google. But if there's a service where you have a login that it's to change the password and maybe store the password somewhere, but like not somewhere that's accessible to you, and then just don't have it in auto dial. And that was the way I broke my addiction to online dominion. Among other things, which got pretty bad at some point in 2021. All right. So now someone could beat me at Dominion because I haven't been playing this all day. So, what if you're making apps? So there's two questions. What's your approach to making the app? Which I think, you know, now that I'm actually involved in making an app, I want to think about this stuff because I don't want it to waste people's time. It does take, you know, the app I'm building is taking people's time. So I hope to make it a little bit more intentional. We'll see how, if we can do it like that. But then there's also...
That raises an interesting question because, and I don't know how much we've talked about it on the show, but that is an app that does not involve you looking at your screen. And so I wonder if that breaks some of the chain of addiction here.
Right, because it points out things in the real world.
You still need to have your phone with you, but because it's audio-based, you know, that it's a different mechanism.
That's quite possible. But then there's also, what if you're a software developer? What if you're in this world? You're going to have your phone on you at all time. You're going to have to be checking Slack. You're going to have to be on call. You're going to have to be always on call. I like meetings to be at specific times, not like we'll call you when we need you. So your work environment really matters. And I feel like
I've developed a bad habit with having a work phone that when I get up in the morning, I check my work email and my Teams messages, and often before I go to bed at night, I'll do the same. And I'm not on the clock, so I shouldn't be doing that.
Right. I think a lot of workspaces, or just the anxiety around your workspace, kind of it causes us to get into bad habits. I don't know how to fix it.
I haven't read the book, but I have heard, I think I heard Newport being interviewed, or if not, some people talking about some of those other books. So it might have been the deep work one, but I think he talks about, you know, having shutdown rituals and making a ritualistic end to your day. And part of that is basically, you know, like disconnecting from all of your work tools and services. Like you mentioned before, with the work from home, that becomes even more important. That I have a default ritual if I'm going into the office. That I've got a 15-minute drive home, and so that is a kind of a forced disengagement, regardless. But
right,
you have to bring more intentionality to it if you're working from home where your commute is, okay, I'm going to walk, you know, possibly from one room to another, or you know, it may literally be, okay, I'm going to, you know, turn around in my chair. So instead of, you know, facing this one wall, now I'm facing the other and I'm out of work mode. And that may not be enough to shift gears in your brain.
Yeah. And there's a ritualistic start to the day as well, whether you're stretching or, you know, meditation. Some people do prayer, some people, you know, but there's a lot you can do. For me, I feel like if I'm in a time of high anxiety, it makes sense to add these practices in, but then, you know, then they always kind of disappear when I'm back in the zone of like working and everything. So I don't know. It certainly is useful to have that intentionality. Certainly a good one for going to sleep is just kind of reading, you know. That's always a nice one.
I get frustrated when I fall asleep like one page into a book because usually that means that I'm exhausted. But
yeah, it happens. And then
alternatively, the book is so engaging that I realize it's 3 a.m. and I'm still reading.
Yeah, that's good too, I guess, because you're getting something done.
It's good in the moment. It's not so good, you know, 6 hours later when I'm at work and falling asleep.
Yeah, and they're like, what were you at a all-night rager party last night? And you're like, no, reading a book. All right, so I want to wrap this up for a second on Cal Newport's before we move over to the Post article, which is related. I wanted to keep all the related things together. So that was the basic idea of the book. And so I think I'm going to use some of this, and hopefully it will get me a different perspective, dare I say an expanded perspective, on everything that's going on so that we can bring better analysis to you here on the Local Maximum. What do you think about that, Aaron?
I think it's a laudable goal, but I think you hit it right on the nose before when you talked about, you know, you don't clean the house and then you're done. You got to clean it, and then you got to clean it again, and it'll creep in, and you got to clean it again. So it's an ongoing process that you got to stay on top of things.
There needs to be almost a cadence to it. Like every quarterly? Quarterly sounds about right, I think. Once a year.
This is going to be a good nudge for me to unsubscribe from some emails. I hinted at this before, but I have, by accident, taken a little bit of a digital detox between traveling and then, you know, having a sick kid and real busy week at work. And I have barely, if at all, logged onto Discord or Slack in the last 2 to 3 weeks. Mm. And I'm kind of dreading going back because I have not that I don't want to go back, because I think there's some good interactions I have there that I kind of miss, but I have a completionist nature to me. And so I feel obligated that if I go back, I've got to read everything I missed in the last 2 weeks in every single channel. And that is a terrible idea. I need to go in with intentionality and maybe I can look and see if there are, you know, specific things that were sent directly to me. But everything else, I should probably just nuke it, you know, set all notifications to zero and start over.
You have lived your life way closer to Cal Newport than I have, because you have not been on Facebook and Twitter. But you're telling me you're skeptical of what I'm telling you here. I think being our age and resisting the allure of that kind of social media is pretty unique there, Aaron.
In some ways, perhaps. Yeah, I've definitely had times, though, where I've gotten sucked into the Reddit whirlpool. And for a while, I was, you know, pretty active on Quora, which became...
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Very useless years ago. I occasionally still get poked because I've got a bunch of answers on there that once in a while somebody likes or comments on. But yeah, there's just because I haven't been on the 800-pound gorilla social networks doesn't mean I haven't fallen victim to some of the negative side effects. I mean, the one that makes me feel the dirtiest is YouTube Shorts, because I will go on there and I will watch thing after thing after thing. And And it doesn't even take very long for me to feel, oh, I wasted like 90 minutes doing this when I could have been reading a book or just getting more sleep. And I did
walking.
This.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most of it is, you know, clips of comedy stuff, which, yeah, they're funny, but I wasn't about to sit down and watch a 90-minute comedy special. And if I had, I probably would have had a better experience doing that with that kind of intentionality rather than watching, you know, 30 or 40 little, you know, 2-minute clips.
So Aaron, when you do your digital detox and you institute digital minimalism, what are you going to do with all your newfound time?
Well, I have a backlog of books that I'm supposed to be reading. So
I see.
That'll keep me busy for a little while.
Anything we can review?
Spending more time with my kids.
Yeah. Anything we review on the Local Maximum? Well, that's a good time. You spend a lot of time with your kids. I know.
I need to spend more time with my kids outside. That's
oh,
the
I see.
For us.
Yeah.
They're not, take them outside. They're not outdoor kids enough.
Okay. Okay.
But
you've got a nice outdoors there.
Yeah. Yeah. And we need to take advantage of it. They don't have cell phones and hopefully won't for a long time, but they do have tablets and that has proven challenging. And my daughter, she has her school laptop, but she'll do some of, you know, it's all quote unquote educational games, but she gets sucked into that sometimes. And it wouldn't be so frustrating if when I called their names, they responded instead of zoning out. But, you know, that's a classic parental complaint, even without computers.
I don't think getting sucked into a math or reading game is the worst thing in the world.
No, it could certainly be worse. And I will give props to, the PBS Kids and their various games and apps and shows that of all the things they could be doing on a screen, those are probably the least bad.
Yeah. I mean, we used to do that growing up with Math Blaster.
Oh yeah.
I'm trying to remember all the different Oregon Trail even, which to this day has helped me learn American history. but there are all these math and reading games that were very addictive, even on machines back then, but that were actually also very educational. So I think when I stop spending all my time liking things and making dumb comments on Reddit, I'm going to go write a book, a nonfiction book, something that will last potentially longer.
Don't give that stuff away for free. You know, put it in a book.
Yeah, exactly.
If your hot takes aren't so hot anymore, then that might become book material.
Right. Well, you know, book is something that should be, I want to write something that will still be relevant in a few years, and not just write something that is kind of flash in the pan, but we'll see if I can do that. I feel like we've gotten so many good ideas over the years on the Local Maximum that we could see what's still relevant that we've talked about before and then kind of put it together. But anyway, not enough about that. Let's move on. Because there's a very provocative headline in the New York Post. Kids' phone-based existence is inhuman and 10 times worse than any middle school horrors, author says. Now, this author is someone I've heard of before. His name is Jonathan Haidt. He is actually an NYU professor, where I teach now. He also wrote a book called The Righteous Mind about... Do you know what the main thrust of that book was? Because I feel like I have an idea, but I'm not quite... I definitely have heard amazing things about that book that people should read it.
I have not read it, but I've heard quite a bit of discussion of it. And I think a big piece of it was how people's, you know, kind of concepts of values and morality break down and drawing some big conclusions about how people on the right versus people on the left, what they value and what they consider important. And I think part of it was also how they model the other side. And a big part of it was that it's not just that they have values that are on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's that for some groups, there's a complete axis that is absent for the other group. And so it makes it difficult for them to mentally model. And I think I'm hesitant to paraphrase because I might get some of the details wrong here, but I think there was a dimension that was common to people on the right, which people on the left tended to not possess. People on the right were, well, I think it was that of, you know, let's, I'm oversimplifying, but, you know, let's say that there are six dimensions that they were measuring things on, that people on the left generally saw everything in the context of four, whereas people on the right saw them in the context of six. And so that enabled the people on the right to more accurately model the people on the left, but the people on the left had a much bigger blind spot where those other two dimensions were that made it difficult for them to model people on the right.
Don't quote me
on that because I may be missing some important nuance there.
It says on Wikipedia that in the first section he shows, and this makes a lot of sense, people's beliefs are driven by intuition and then reasoning mostly used to justify those beliefs. That's what we all do. Hopefully our intuition doesn't fail us too much, though, because I feel like sometimes our intuition pulls through and gives us what we need. But anyway, let's go back to this. So this is kind of a... he is a very kind of well-known social scientist, and he has another book coming out called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Children is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, that parents are sending children to a virtual planet for untold hours every day. And it starts with, would you send your kid to Mars? Would you let Elon Musk send your kid to Mars to live a new life? No. So why are you letting these other billionaires send them to not just digital land, but their particular version of digital land? Hayton, NYU Stern professor of ethical leadership, writes that the past decade has seen the radical transformation of childhood into something inhuman, a phone-based existence. The book is coming out March 26th, and he argues that smartphones and social media have contributed to a great rewiring, causing sleep deprivation, social deprivation, attention fragmentation, addiction, and spiritual degradation. That's an interesting word. I'm not quite sure, you know, how you would measure spiritual degradation, but I'm sure that you could dive deeper into his research. Hayt said both his children have benefited from a family rule of no social media until 16. He recommends that other parents do the same and hold off on smartphones until high school. We have to delay the phones, but also give them engaging activities in the real world. Parents have underprotected children online, but we've also overprotected them in the real world, and we need to address both halves. It's funny. I feel like we've overprotected children in the real world. This is where the fourth turning comes in. We're sort of at the height of overprotection of children. We've protected them online against certain things, but we haven't protected them against companies trying to, you know, make money off of your intention. And that is a big problem. So kids need to be anchored in the real world with real relationships, real responsibilities, real love, virtual activities. Don't substitute, he added. As a professor, Hayt said Gen Z has been receptive to his message and eager to change. So I didn't read the whole Post article. You could get the New York Post if that's the kind of paper that you get and read the whole thing, or you could wait for the book to come out and get the book. But I found that this is very interesting and related to digital minimalism. It's just like, I feel like the zeitgeist society is reacting in a whole different way. In like, let's pick another year at random, like 2009, it would be fun to have your kid on Facebook, right? Like, I don't know, funny in the sense of like, oh, look, there's your kid on Facebook. And it wouldn't like be a problem for the kid because Facebook did not have that endless feed of that we have now, or Instagram, for example. You know, so I think that as the tech industry has inshittified, we've adjusted our culture a little bit. Let's see if this backlash actually, you know, I think it will amount to things. I'm not sure where it will. I think that the culture is changing on this. Finally,
that brings two things to mind.
Who we're not going to see some changes in terms of, I have to just mention, we're not going to see changes in human nature. There's always new products that are exciting, that's helpful, that you want to be on. And then, you know, as they get more mature, the companies get lazy and, you know, you get into the same rut of, you know, not being so healthy for you. So that that cycle's going to go over and over again. But I feel like this one problem, particular problem with, you know, being people getting getting their so-called rewiring their brains online will be solved, at least in this particular way. Sorry, go ahead.
It reminds me of two things. The first being, and I feel remiss for not remembering where I heard this story, but it was someone who was in college, you know, during the early days of the internet, and he was working on something completely, well, maybe not completely unrelated, but not directly related. But he got in his head that, like, this internet thing, it could be a real big deal. There's some cool stuff going on there, and it was distracting him from the research work he was supposed to be doing. And he had to sit down with his advisor, and his advisor said, okay, take the weekend, read the whole internet, and then get back to work. And this was, it wasn't early enough that was something you could actually do, but it was still early enough that a lot of people thought that was something you could do. but the other thing you mentioned as the flip side of the delaying phones and engaging them in activities in the real world that you know give them you know that underprotected online but overprotected in the real world. It reminded me of a recent podcast episode I listened to about raising free range kids and how one particular guest did that with her son when he was growing up. And there's some stuff that I aspire to that. You know, we were kind of the generation after the latchkey kids, but there's some stuff that I perhaps nostalgically want to bring back from that era. And I would love to be able to raise my kids in a way that, you know, they can hop on their bikes and ride to a friend's house and hang out in the neighborhood and, you know, just be home in time for dinner. That is pretty much non-existent in a cell phone world. And that maybe there are some ways to safely recreate that, but it takes, again, that buzzword, it takes intentionality. You can't kind of fall backwards into it. You got to put effort into it.
Right. And it almost needs to be rediscovered or rebuilt by the people who lived through it or have read about it.
Yeah. So we have. I listened to Height being interviewed. I was actually listening to it this morning, talking about this, and it put me in mind of, well, if I don't want my kids to have a cell phone, you know, you could go the dumb phone route, the flip phone route. But it almost made me consider, you know, I have a phone line to my house. I've never actually had a landline phone connected to it. But maybe that can be the compromise, is that we get a phone there, and it's, if you want to talk to my kids, you call this phone number, and, you know, let them go 90s old school. You know, if you want to talk all night on the phone with your friends, you can, but you got to use the landline. And that maybe that would be a reason to bring that back. You know, given that I've been cell phone only for 20 something years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, then there's the weird thing where you have to talk to someone's parents to get to the person.
Which is almost in a helicopter parent way, kind of ideal. Like, you want to know who your kids are talking to, and maybe you don't want to listen in on them, but you want a touch point there.
Yeah, I think exactly. It almost reminds me. So I know someone who has a story. I won't say who it is. It takes place in 2007. So this person was an adult at the time, dating an adult who lived with her parents. And I don't know if he didn't realize or if he was drunk or tired or out of it. He left a really dirty message on the answering machine. So this is like right at the end of that. And
I guess at that point in time, it probably wasn't an answering machine with an actual like tape inside of it. It was probably all digital, but
yeah.
Oh man. I remember bringing an answering machine with me to college so that I could connect it to the phone line I think it wasn't in the dorm room. I think it was in my fraternity at that time. So people could leave me a message on it. That was a little bit of anachronism at that point because I already had a cell phone, but
yeah, I don't think we realized how much of an anachronism it was. Like, it's at some point you probably realized you didn't have to use it.
Yeah. It did not get much use.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's good enough for today. I want to know what you guys think. localmaxradio@gmail.com or comment on Substack. I'm going to move everybody's accounts on Locals to Substack so that you can comment on there. If you want to talk to us but you don't want to sign up, then you can just go to go to our email, localmaxradio@gmail.com. But have you been struggling with this? Or not struggling. Have you been dealing with this? Have you been thinking about this? I want to know the thoughts of the audience. And I think it's a good way to kind of start off this year. And I know we're in March, but we're really kicking off the season here with this discussion, which has been a long time coming on the Local Maximum. But I feel like this is for some reason, this is a very good time to bring it up. I don't know if it's my life only, but it's
And I'd be very curious. I mean, I'm sure we have plenty of listeners who might have kids, and you know, listeners who grew up with cell phones. People like us who got them, maybe got our first cell phone in high school or when we went off to college or younger. But I'm really curious. How young our youngest listeners are. Do we have any listeners who are, currently teenagers, and how has this impacted them growing up in the ever evolving landscape here?
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I think that's it for today. Any last thoughts, Aaron, or were those your last thoughts?
Those were my last, well, now that sounds ominous. Those were my last thoughts on this subject.
Okay, well, come back next week because I want to really talk about cellular automata because it's a really fun topic. And we also have some other mathematical topics that I have on the back burner that I would like to discuss, and I wouldn't want to do a solo show on them. So
yeah, well, we didn't have a probability distribution of the week, but as you mentioned when we started off, distribution of episodes over time has been somewhat irregular, but that means that they might be coming fast and furious, or they might not. So stay tuned to find out.
Well, we're going to put more intentionality into our episodes.
It's the word of the day.
There you go, intentionality. All right, have a great week, everyone. That's the show. The Local Maximum is now hosted on Substack. To support the show, join our online community on localmaximum.substack.com. Find show notes and additional materials at our website, localmaxradio.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. Remember to subscribe on your podcast app. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.